I'm Scott Slaba, and I'm here to give a presentation on titled What Profiteth the Human Spirit or the Human Soul. That's the title. I didn't come here prepared to do this today, so I put this together this afternoon. And that's okay, we'll see what happens, we'll see what comes up. As I was thinking about giving a presentation on money and profit, I got up to hold it and seeing how beautiful it is up here, it seems very incongruous with the setting. And I'm surprised that, you know, in a way that anybody's here at all, because profit and money is not a very popular subject. It's not something that people like to talk about a whole lot. It's not something that most of us think too much about. When we think about money, Linda made a comment a little while ago. You mentioned the word money and people, their eyes sort of glaze over. But I feel that the word, that profit, in the sense that I'm getting at, has a spiritual dimension to it. And because I have been affiliated and working in the business world for some time, about 16 years essentially since I graduated in 1972, I have done a lot of thinking about the problems of our culture in relation to business. And I've been trying to extract from the business terminology and business language cultural and spiritual elements in order to be able to understand them a little bit better. And the one I thought I would deal with or address tonight is the word profit. I graduated in 1972 from Iowa State University with a degree in business administration and philosophy. And it wasn't because I wanted two degrees, I just couldn't decide which way to go. So I've been spending about the last 15 years trying to figure out which is more important or how to fit together. So this is a part of that long tradition that I've got. When you say the word profit to somebody, what you think of is, it's a word that we use a lot in our language. We use it a lot every day. You say, oh, it was profitable. Or you hear a lot about profitable enterprises. You hear a lot about things, profitable ways to manage your time, profitable ways to, you know, to increase your income, to increase your sex appeal, ways to profit your, to make your career more profitable, your time management more profitable. It's a word that we sort of throw around a lot, and it's generally, I think, associated with good things. I mean, the idea of profit, I think of the word desirable, I think of the word good, adequate, meaningful, all of those words are associated with the word profit. But if we take that word, and we take the word, the emotional words that go with profit, and we explore them, we usually find that sooner or later they can be translated to monetary terms. If you say to somebody, it was a good day. Well, the term profit I'm trying to make the analogy here. If you say something is good, if you explore the word profit, if I ask you what words come up when you think of profit and you say the word good or desirable, what you're usually thinking about is something that has a value to it. But when you take the word profit in the business sense, profit has a quantifiable dimension to it. Profit means quantifiable in the traditional business sense of the word. I was in the business world, the term profit usually means the excess that you have, excess over expenses. Okay? So if I take something and I sell it, if it costs me $6 to produce, say, a Teflon pan, and I sell that Teflon pan for, say, $16. Okay.
Now, I'm taking really a chance here to write these figures down, because the chance of you phasing out on me is really high at this point. Okay?
We'll stay with you.
All right. See. Okay. This is my Teflon pan. I'm making a Teflon pan. And I'm going to sell that Teflon pan for $16. Okay? It costs me, let's say, $6 to make it. This is my profit. $10. Okay. If I sell, say, 50 of these in a day, I have a profit of, say, $500. Okay? It's a good day. It's a profitable day. A good day. Okay? Now, let's say that over the course of 6 years, well, let's just say that in the process of doing this, of making this Teflon pan, I also make, say, 4 pounds of toxic waste, or 4 gallons, okay, which I then put into a toxic disposal site, which then leaks into the water supply, all right? Okay, so that I go through time, and over the course of, say, 5 or 6 years, I make 20,000 of these things. And in the course of that time, I make 1,200 gallons of toxic waste that's leaking into the water supply. All right? Along comes the Environmental Protection Agency, and it says, you have to clean this up. The bill for that, $600,000, we'll say. Okay? In the course of that time, I have made, say, 20,000 of these pans. 20,000. $600,000 cost to clean up the toxic waste. 20,000 of these Teflon pans comes to $30 a pan. Okay? Now, who's going to pay for this? Where's this going to come out of? We originally started out, the guy who's making the Teflon pans had $6, we thought. But now we find out there was a hidden cost, $30 a pan. Okay, $16, we still sold it for $16. We have the $6, the original expense, but now we have $30 added to that, $36 total expense, making a net loss $20 a pan. Now, in an ideal society or an ideal culture, the guy who made this originally would have to pick up that cost. But he's gone. Or she's gone. He's invested the money he made, the $10 a pan, in some investment in Taiwan or Asia somewhere. Who's going to foot the bill for this $20 a pan? It's going to be you, it's going to be me, and it's going to be the environment. And down the road, all the people who drink that toxic waste in their food supply, they're going to have to foot the bill for that. Okay? Now, the only reason that we aren't forcing this guy who made this Teflon pan to pick up that loss and pay for it is because that's the way the culture is set up. He distanced himself from the effect of his actions enough so that he isn't going to have to pay for the real cost of that Teflon pan. So the idea of the profit requires, the idea of profit in this sense and the real cost of it in this sense requires some distance in time. It had to 5 years or 6 years or 10 years had to pass. Our memories are short. We tend to forget. In the meantime, the guy who made them is gone. This is a critical element of profitability, distancing yourself from the outcome. And we need to remember that, because it reoccurs in practically every case where there is a hidden expense. Short-term profit turns out to be long-term loss. Okay? Recently, 2 days ago, I went through some old papers. I have a fetish for collecting old newspaper articles and items on profitability and business and such. I came across this one, dated October 19th. It says, the San Francisco earthquake, the title of this is Quake Will Benefit Some Industries. It says, the San Francisco earthquake damaged facilities of some banks, computer chip makers, and other local companies, but the disaster may yet prove a boon to other businesses. The disaster may prove a boon. Makers of lumber, concrete, and glass, and even service providers like insurance underwriters could eventually profit, analysts say. Now, the article goes on to debate the issue. Some economists say, well, that's true. Disaster is good for business. Others say it's not. 4 days later, well, this was on Thursday, 4 days later on Monday, apparently the debate had been somewhat resolved, because this time the headline says, investors see silver lining in quake. The article starts out like this. Call it opportunity or ghoulish economics. We're given a choice here. Opportunity or ghoulish economics. But the killer California earthquake of 1989 has aroused enthusiasms among investors and speculators as a new source of multi-billion dollar profits. Now, what we've got here is distance. We can be sure that the people who wrote that article, the investors who are looking at this as a source of multi-billion dollar investments, don't have a relative who was killed in it, you can be sure. Their house wasn't demolished. They're sitting somewhere in a calm, quiet Manhattan investment brokerage firm, speculating on the boom that's going to come from all of the construction resulting from the earthquake. Distance again. Now we see this. I have a pocket full of these articles. I mean, I over the last 3 or 4 years, when the drought came, remember the drought 2 years ago or a year and a half ago? They were speculating. They were speculating at that time on whether or not the commodities market was going to boom because of the drought. Prices were going to go up. The psychological counseling industry was going crazy because they were counseling farmers who were contemplating suicide, the good growth industry. Bhopal, when that happened, less than a week after the Bhopal tragedy happened, they were up speculating whether or not who was going to make the most off of this money. And they speculated correctly. It was the lawyers and the financial counselors who stepped in, who made millions off of it. The average Indian affected made a few thousand dollars. It looks like now the settlement was somewhere around $420,000. This kind of thing goes on all the time. You see a tragedy, you see profits being made off it. Distance requires distance. To put it in a Christian perspective, which is what we need to do as Christians, I have an article here which came about in the Catholic Worker 2 months ago. Some of you may see it. I've seen it. Called Beneath the Burden of Debt. And it's a very fine article. And I'm going to read part of this to you because it's pretty incredible. This is by Al Levine. Does anybody know Al Levine? Or has met him? I haven't myself, but he's a fine writer. It's hard to see what big problems like international debt crisis, which not even professional economists understand completely, have to do with ordinary people. These ordinary people have nothing to be ashamed of, because the Comptroller of the United States Treasury doesn't seem to know what international debt means to him personally either. On January 5th, 1989,
In a hearing before the House Banking Committee on the debt crisis of the less developed countries, the comptroller, Robert Clark, was questioned by Joseph Kennedy of Massachusetts. Mr. Clark and others had been describing how the Baker Plan, devised by former Treasury Secretary James Baker, had kept commercial banks solvent, even though lots of third world countries can't pay back their loans. The following is from the stenographer's transcript. Mr. Kennedy says, "There is no question that the Baker Plan is going to help out the U.S. banks. It's also going to kill a lot of children." Mr. Clark responds, "That's not the point I'm trying to make." Mr. Kennedy says, "I know that." Mr. Clark, "It has enabled the countries as well to deal with their problems in a much more orderly manner." That's not all Mr. Clark said, of course, but it's worth stopping here to ask a few questions and comment briefly. Are third world children actually being killed so their countries can pay off their debts to the developed world, namely us? The answer, according to a new report by the United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, is definitely yes. It says it can be estimated that at least 500,000 young children have died in the last 12 months as the result of the slowing down or the reversal of progress in the developing world, which is the result of unprecedented borrowing, rising interest rates, falling commodity prices, inadequate investment of borrowed funds, and the domestic and international management of the resulting debt crisis. Note that 500,000 dead children is not the total number killed by poverty in undeveloped countries. It is simply the number killed in excess of what might have been predicted because of the worsening of the world economy. The former president of Tanzania, Julius Nyerere, stated the problem much more pithily than UNICEF when he said, "Must we starve our children to pay our debts?" At this point, a reasonably skeptical person might say, how can the transactions of high finance kill babies? Ecological catastrophe in places like Ethiopia can, war in countries like Angola can, but how is it possible for an electronic transfer of funds to kill a living infant as definitely as a volcanic eruption? Developing countries now owe over $1 trillion. Repayments now add up to nearly 25% of what these countries earn in exports. The repayments. The countries of the poor South, because they are struggling to pay this debt and because they are forced to sell their raw materials at bargain prices to us, are transferring as much as $60 billion a year to us. Is this what students of the human mind call inappropriate effect? If your child or mine were dying of diarrhea, would we tell ourselves to be patient, to wait until we had finished off paying our bank loans before calling a doctor? One can't help thinking that in your thoughts or mine, or possibly Mr. Clark's, are the words, perhaps buried deeply, "Thank God none of those kids are my kids or grandchildren or the children or grandchildren of friends or even acquaintances." Or, as the popular saying goes, better the you than me. If a dying child isn't an emergency, what is? The numbers in the testimony, indeed, are very large, and the exposure is, in truth, significant. Mr. Clark is talking about money. Let's be honest about it. Let's picture our national selves. For Mr. Clark, as an individual, is by no means a villain or a monster. We are not monsters. We all know instinctively that when Jesus said, "Render unto Caesar," he didn't mean the dying bodies of children. Then how does it happen that when you talk to a man about dead children, the answer you receive is about money? What is wrong with us? Make no mistake, when a society literally slaughters children, it is sick. When it weighs the lives of 500,000 dead children against the abstract concept of bank solvency, one is tempted to use the word evil. But as individuals, we are not evil. That being so, how do we explain all the small dead bodies, the crippled, deprived children? It seems obvious that there is a gap between our personal compassion and the translation into national social terms. This is not our problem alone, nor is it the United States, the worst of all countries. In collectivities as well as persons, it's a mixed bag. Yet we are losing our capacity to respond to that evil on a level larger than that of our personal lives. And the symbol of that evil in our particular society happens to be money. People in the past, in grievous error, have killed in the name of democracy, liberty, national sovereignty, living space, justice, revenge, and even of God. But how does the battle cry, "Die in the name of money," sit with you? Of course, what Mr. Levine is talking about is not just money. He's talking about profit, again, the excess of revenue over expense. And of course, the only way that Mr. Clark can talk about profit in those terms is distance. As he says, "Thank God they're not my children, or my relatives' children, or my grandchildren." Distance again. Distance is the critical factor. So, I have done some thinking about that issue. What does it mean to us as Christians, as spiritual people, as business people? What does it mean? What do we do with that reality once we understand what the word profit means on a social scale? Most of us, I think, certainly I do, I tend to, for a long time, look at the word profit as bad. And then I go about my business of trying to clean up my own life. And so I assume the businessmen over there will do their dirty deeds, and I won't be one of them. I'll be a part of their reality because I have to make money, and I have to live, and sometimes I have to be in business, but I don't really want to look at the fact of what's going on here. What's going on in the case of the Teflon pans, or the case of the people making money off of the disaster and the earthquake, or the people in Bhopal, or the people who are, the children who are dying in South or Central America because of the need to make profit. I write the word profit off as a dirty word. But I think we can do more with it than that. And so I would suggest, and the point of this discussion is that the first thing that we as people need to do in whatever ways we can, when we see the word profit, sensitize ourselves to headlines like these when you see it's going on. Sensitize yourself, all of us, we need to sensitize ourselves to this issue, to seeing what is really happening in the name of profit and money. Okay, that's one thing. And then we need to begin to re-perceive the idea of what profit could mean. Quite honestly, I think we can have a healthy profit, but it has to be a profit that takes into consideration all the costs of our actions. It has to look beyond this month or next month and look down the road to our children, to our grandchildren, down the road, and realize that we're all in the garden here. We're all in infinity, and our actions have consequences. And once we begin doing that, little by little, and people are, we can see that there are things that are really profitable. Solar energy, for example, may be really profitable. Think of what happens when you plant a seed in your garden. You take a little seed, and you get a full tomato that fills your belly. That's real profit. That's the kind of model for profit we need to look at. Something that's a part of a living system. And to do that, we need to insist that those companies we buy from, those companies we patronize, the companies we work for, take into consideration. We need to demand that they look at all of the costs, the long-term costs, and recognize this is a system that we're all a part of, and our consequences are felt down the line. I have recently begun trying to do something about this in my own life. I have been working as an accountant full-time at the university where I am, in Bellingham. And I have been struggling for 6 months to get onto a job share situation so I can do this kind of work. And I just started this, which is part of the reason I'm here, by the way. If I was working my 40-hour shift, I wouldn't be here. So that's a victory of sorts for me. But I've started what I've called the Value-Based Management Institute. It's a fledgling little idea that's beginning to be on the ground for me. And in addition to doing things like free debt counseling for people,
free financial counseling, which is what I'm going to pursue. I want to educate people to this idea that what we have to do is demand more of the corporations that serve us. I noticed in the bookstore several good books. I was browsing around, books you might want to check out. One's called Money and Power. Right by the check stand is a little booklet, a little consumer guide that rates your corporations. You can take that with you to the grocery store. That's a start. That's what we're talking about here. Demanding long-term accountability. What I thought I would do is close by just reading what I consider a manifesto, Value-Based Management Manifesto. This would be for people who would be managing businesses under this value-based idea that I'm talking about. And I'll read you this that I wrote several months ago so you can get a feel for what I'm saying. Part of it anyway, I'll read part of it. It's a manifesto I thought somebody could take. As a value-based manager, I represent a business management school of thought in which financial decisions are based on human rather than on capital considerations. I am a business person committed to the wealth that springs from serving the human spirit rather than from manipulating resources in the service of short-term profit. While not denying in any sense the need for profit, I support the idea of profit in a long-term context as a growth of a spiritual, ethical existence. I am working to make being in business synonymous with a way of life that expresses the full range of material, intellectual, emotional, and spiritual needs we all share. I survive by nurturing a spirit that is sometimes elusive, often hard to quantify. A quality way of being in business that serves the well-being of myself, my community, and my planet. To this end, I stand in alliance with fellow business people who wish to engage in a form of free enterprise that honors human beings and overcomes the isolation of this fiercely individualized, competitive, capital-based culture. As a value-based manager, I divorce myself from capitalism's obsessive preoccupation with capital accumulation over human value, knowing full well that to do so is to risk being called a communist, a libertarian, a crackpot, whatever. But I want to be thought of simply as an ethical entrepreneur who makes my living through the commitment I show to a long-term bettering of the human condition. I see my way of doing business as representative of a long-standing democratic, equalitarian tradition in this country that places the rights of the person superior to the rights of the property. As a value-based manager, I will be counted among that tenacious, loyal group of world-class citizens who are the legitimate heirs of the American dream. That's the notion of profit that I wanted to convey tonight. A long-term sense, there is profit, and suggest that we all can do something in the way we consume, what we demand of our businesses, and that to do so is not just an economic act. It's not just something business people do and we as spiritual people can ignore, but that to demand accountability from our corporations and our businesses is also a spiritual act as well. And that's what I have to say. Are there any questions? Scott?
Yeah. First, I want to clap.
Yeah.
Perhaps you could list for us some of your thoughts about strategies. We just came from a community across the seas. Made up largely of executives of large multinational corporations who are basically convinced that the success that why they're in business is to make money. They think it's a wonderful ideal that the reason why businesses should exist is to provide meaningful work for people, but they say, well, that's just, that's an idealist view. That won't fly in our world today. They're convinced that they can only make money, or that they're convinced that the world is essentially a competitive marketplace, and the only way they can make money is if they can produce the same product at less expense, and so they're constantly looking for ways to, as you would say, distance themselves from expenses, so that they can. And so they would. I would think if I was one of them listening to you, I'd say, well, that's all good and fine, but you know, you live in some other kind of world. And how are you ever going to create a state in a world where this, where people are going to own up to what it really costs?
It's a difficult issue because that is true. And I think they're absolutely right. On one hand, it is very difficult to survive in business if you don't play the game of business. It's very, very difficult to do that. Okay, they're absolutely correct. The idea that I think needs to be imparted to people when I talk to business people, and I talk to a lot of business people who are about this, these ideas whenever I can, is that you'll encounter a certain kind of cynicism. It's just there. It's just in the air. And then if you are serious about it, that sort of shifts a little bit, because underlying that is the genuine concern. There is a real concern among business people. And there's this feeling of, yeah, we're all a little nervous about what's going on, but what do we do? And I think the issue that you're talking about can only be addressed by persistence. Persistence and also a reminder to people who you find yourself in contact with that it's already happening. The concern, the global concern, is there. Good businesses, businesses that run their business well, are already beginning to emerge. It's not what I would call a national phenomenon yet, but read the newspapers. Tell them to check in. If you read the Wall Street Journal like I do every day, you will find in about two or three times a week, you'll find coverage of companies that are beginning to develop new systems for toxic waste. Toxic waste control is a big industry. It's a growing industry. Industries are becoming states. I should go back a step. States are becoming more and more stringent in terms of environmental standards. It's very, very difficult. It will be in the next 5 years to do the kind of thing we're talking about here, the kind of trashing. What I would remind somebody in the proper context, okay, when it was appropriate, what I would remind them is that it's happening and that this is good business. This is going to be good business.
I think you can point to the success of like the Calvert Social Equity Fund and working assets. You can invest money responsibly and have a phenomenal success rate, especially the Calvert funds have done really well, and they're very selective about where they invest. They have a real stringent criteria. I think those are really good concrete examples of how it can work.
Yeah, that's a good point. In this booklet that you'll find in the bookstore, check it out, there are about 12 categories. And one thing that you can mention to people too is that they can't be perfect. They can only strive towards a sense of global awareness. But you're right. There are socially responsible businesses that are beginning, many of them on a very small scale. I see it happening a lot just in the level of quality of products that people want to put out on a small scale. There are companies that are investing heavily into the solar industry. The problem with solar power right now is that the big companies don't know how to centralize it. They don't know how to make a lot of money on it. But they know it's necessary. They know it's coming. That's right. They've got to turn a profit on it. But the issue of you take a look at corporations. One that comes to mind for me is the McDonald's Corporation. Okay, you have to look in little places. Big companies making little things. Their stance on styrofoam. That has been, if you follow it, you look at what's happening. This has been over the. I was talking, the people I knew, we were talking about these issues 15 years ago. The hydrofluorocarbons that come out of the damage the ozone. The styrofoam issue. Well now, in 1986, they're starting to do something about it. The problem is they've got millions of these styrofoam canisters. They've got hundreds of millions of dollars invested in that technology. They don't know what to do. But that's not to say it's the change isn't coming. That's the kind of thing that people need to be alerted to, that there is a change happening. And that is being manifest. I would say within 3 to 5 years, you won't be able to buy styrofoam. Okay. As a good example of where industries are beginning to respond. Toxic waste is a big one too.
But it doesn't really come out of their value. I mean, it comes out of
their pocket.
Yeah.
They don't do it out. No, you're right.
I don't know. I'm not saying that's good or bad or what the effect will be. But
they're not doing it out of the goodness of their heart. They would rather.
I don't think they ever will.
No.
I don't think the only way you're going to initiate this thing is through legislation, tax incentives. To convince them, like you say, that it's coming and that it will be better business to change.
That's where it comes down to individual responsibility, too, because they're changing in response to a demand.
Exactly.
And we're creating that demand. People
and that's
are
where
saying,
we fit in.
Yeah. Exactly.
Right, it's creating that through pressure on legislation.
I think it's important, too, that these companies, like what Dan's talking about, that. If that people come to me, you know, you're a young person, you're going to start getting a job and making money and all this, and you start investing in these places. And I just wasn't aware that there were places where you could socially, responsibly invest money and still, at the end of 10 years, have the kind of profits that they talk about by investing in South Africa or whatever. And I think that if people are given a choice and know about it, they would rather make money doing socially responsible things that make money, investing money in South Africa. It's just that people don't know about it. People aren't aware of it. And
I think that's also where individual role models come in. I think in terms of Scott and his office under the accounting department at Western, and he was certainly unique among that office and one of the first to start pushing for job share situation. And people thought he was crazy. You know, you're going to cut your salary in half. Here you have this nice, secure job. What are you doing? And so he has a chance to talk to people a lot about what he's doing. And it's still an experiment. We don't know how we're going to make it on half the salary either. But the trade-offs are absolutely necessary in our lives.
The interesting thing about modeling is, since I did that, I bet I have, every time I'm up there, work a week and then I'm off a week, I bet I have, on the average, a couple of people a day come up to me in the restroom or in the coffee room. How's the job share going? How's it going? No. Oh, it's great. Oh, yeah, it sounds really good. I wish I could do that. When's your next week off? You know, what are you going to do on your week off? Oh, I'm going up to Holden Village. Really?
I can relate to those stories. A year ago, this past August, I left Holden Village after being here 5 weeks to go into business myself after 25 years of working for companies. And I was supposed to go in partnership with somebody, and that all fell through in the 5 weeks I was here, so I did go into business, but it was with myself, which was okay, actually. And I've probably had more time off in this first year of my business, even when doing things I want to, than I would ever have imagined. And when I came over for this 2 months, I had a chance to work on $1 million house for an entrepreneur that has a lot in Seattle that previously was considered unbuildable. and I just pulled my office and paid through it. I thought that was obscene. But that I would come back and work on a $3 million shelter for the Salvation Army in January. So values can mean something. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, he's consented to do a church for an Oriental organization, community in town, and some of that will be volunteer. So convinced my values influenced him. He's a friend, but he's probably more of a friend in my 2 month absence than he's been in 20 years ago.
Wow.
So
good for you. Good for you. Congratulations. That's a victory.
What idea, Scott, do you have about the, you know, every week in the news you read about the triangles and the Big Apple and amongst the brokerage folks that are scraping all the billions and millions, putting together big deals and you know, millions are being made by shuffling people, not by creating anything. There's this tremendous energy in our land for that. And there's tremendous energy for that. I don't know where that's coming from. And it doesn't matter, you know, whether hundreds of people lose their jobs and talk about distancing yourself. You know, through junk bonds, we put together billions of dollars, which end up throwing hundreds of people out of work, creating huge debts for companies and corporations, you know, and a few profit. In the end, a few people profit from that whole process.
And can illegal.
It's all legal, yeah. I mean,
it's all legal.
That's the trouble, is as long as it's legal, people are going to do it.
And,
yeah.
It's hard. I don't understand. How you can get a handle on that.
It reminds me, just on the, you mentioned the junk bonds. The latest thing on junk bonds is that a junk bond, a bank in California that was specializing in junk bonds, pushing them, was recently indicted along with half a dozen senators who were implicated in the support of this bank. But what they were doing was pushing the junk bonds off onto older senior citizens in the Southwest. And then they declared bankruptcy, and of course in a bankruptcy court, junk bonds are the last thing to get paid. So they had a list of all these old people who had invested $50,000 to $100,000, who had lost it. Mm. Boom, gone. They thought they were insured. And this bank went after those old people. There's clear evidence they were going after them because they knew they would be the least discriminating of the audience. The whole issue reminds me of something about 2 years ago. Do you remember this issue, power ties? Remember? Power ties. You ever hear that term?
Yeah.
Okay. Wall Street was obsessed with this notion of power ties.
And what is a power tie?
Well, I never quite figured it out.
Nobody's in color.
Yeah. It was like, when you wear a tie, there's certain ties that you can feel. Well, apparently they'd analyze this in terms of power. There were power ties, and they were being sold for $60, $80 a tie, you know? And they would wear these things. Of course, the more money that you spent on one, it sort of made you feel more powerful. And Mike Royko got a hold of that. If you're familiar with Mike Royko, he's a satirist, he does wonderful stuff. And he just said, you know, power ties are the signal of a powerlessness. You know, power ties only come about when people are feeling totally powerless. And I really, it rang a bell with me, you know, and I thought about that in response to your question. This flurry of stuff that's going on in a country that is such as ours, that is quickly, it's struggling. We are really struggling at this point economically. And when you follow the papers, you find out just how nervous everybody is about what's coming down in the next 10 years. It's a way of centralizing power. It's a shake-up. it's a way, it kind of takes the same role as the lottery. You know, it keeps the illusion of prosperity alive. Everybody can buy a ticket. Somebody make, you know, we may make a lot of money on our ticket. But the idea of the shakeup, what is going on, as to me signifies an economy and a society that is basically fairly desperate. And I'm not a doomsayer. I'm a very positive person, generally. But when I look at it, and I see what it is doing, it is a centralization of power, clearly. Take, for example, the press. There were something like 150 major independent newspapers, as little as 6 or 7 years ago. By 1992 or 93, there will be about five or six beer producers, five or six media purveyors, five or six auto purveyors. What are they going to do then? Okay, they're going to go in and buy all the stock and control the company. So the company, this little company, little by industry standards, decides it's going to buy back all its stock so this big company can't buy it. So it goes about, where does it, how does it buy back its stock? It goes to the bank, borrows several hundred million dollars, buys back all its stock. Suddenly there it sits. It owns itself now, but it has several hundred million dollars of indebtedness now where it didn't have it before. How is that indebtedness going to be, the interest on that going to be paid in the principal? It's going to be paid in the same way that the big companies have paid theirs, by using the same techniques. They started clear-cutting, they laid off people, they cut back on benefits, and it essentially destroyed the soul of the company. And this, to me, this is an example of the so-called wealth. This is an example, a microcosm for me, of this kind of business is going on a lot of the time. Sometimes it just is gobbled up, the companies. The trading that goes on, the wheeling and dealing, there's nothing. There's no value at all that's created for the most part.
Are there any parallels to what the DuPonts did when they started, or when they started growing so large with the Standard Oil and the antitrust stuff that finally came out, all that? Are there any parallels in history?
I'm not sure.
For that?
I'm not sure which. Well, of course, you're talking about the, well, there was Standard Oil, of course.
Yeah.
Is that what you mean in terms of?
Well, which was, as I understand it, a part of the DuPont expansion in the country, not just in dynamite, but in all kinds of aspects of this country's industrial revolution, where it finally blew up on them.
Yeah, it's hard to get a handle on the question. I know what you're getting at. Like, what is,
as if it's history repeating itself, I guess.
What part of it? What do you?
Are we headed for legislation to control this uncontrolled economy of ours?
Oh, I see no evidence of that. I would.
See, we need to be looking at our legislators.
Yeah.
Who were there?
There's no indication that I have that there's any real move to protect the small people. I think when you, if you really want to get a handle on what's happening in the clearest sense, look at agriculture. That's really the clearest way. You know, agriculture is pretty clear. I mean, it's what's happening in the Midwest, for example, in everywhere is a good example of what is the trend, not towards more protection, which is what we saw in the early 1900s with the antitrust laws, the 1890s. That's not happening at all. It's, if anything, it's moving towards bigger and bigger, just flat out. The small farms in the Midwest are gone. That's a myth. Forget that. You know, you have to have 2,000 acres to survive. That's going to be accelerating. That problem is accelerating. And to me, what has happened in that culture is just repeating itself all over. There's no evidence that I have that that's any different. If anybody knows anything other than I don't know, but I certainly don't see it.
I get the same thing when I wrote my congressman. It was just sort of a, oh yeah, sure, we'll look into it, but he must have missed the Reagan years. You know, this is what what happened during the 80s is that the whole direction is shifting towards this, and you aren't going to slow it down. And it felt really, I felt really helpless. I felt like, my God, if this doesn't shake people up, if this isn't so against our grain, the whole junk bond deal that you're talking about, and the destruction on our productivity, on just our way of life.
Well, having said that, though, we have to remember, though, that there are, like right now, you know, we have to look at the victors, too. And you're right. And I'll just throw this in because it's good to balance that out. The centralization is going on. I don't know where that is. That's a reality.
Right, we have to deal with it.
We have to deal with it. But there is also an awareness of ethical standards. There's an awareness growing of environmental issues. And Jack, you mentioned this issue of the corporations. They don't care, you know, that issue. I think, remember, you talked about the fact that, I don't quite know how I remember how you
they
said it.
They're coming from a value.
Yeah, their value is money, making money. Yeah. That's what they're trained and that's what they're paid to do, is protect money. And that means short-term money. But I think there's two cases, and let's just look at them both real briefly. One is South Africa. When the pressure came down to get out of South Africa, oh man, you read the papers, oh, hey, those South Africans, they're really bad guys. I mean, they are bad, bad, bad. We're going to get out, we're going to divest. Never wanted to be there in the first place. You bet. They jumped right on the bandwagon. Boom, boom, boom. Hundreds of them. You know what they did? They went and they sold their companies to Dutch firms, to Belgian firms. They retained the right to control those firms, but they didn't own them on paper. They were still, you could still find IBM computers down there, you could still find Exxon Oil, you could still find Kodak, you could still, the whole business was going on, but on paper, they were out of Africa. Now there were a few corporations, it's been a while now, was it Kodak? One that I didn't expect, really did pull out, said, okay, we're getting out. Amazing. One of them really got it, you know? They really got the message. They pulled out. They lost lots of money. They got out of there. Most of them didn't. Okay. That's, I think, the issue that we're looking at. There is a soul in some of the people who run it, and we have to look for that. They are very sensitive to our opinion. One negative letter, boy, that'll get them. One letter from a customer that's negative will really have a lot of impact. I know that.
Well, especially with corporations like McDonald's.
That's right. That's right.
We should be running companies rather than legislators.
Oh, I think that's Saul Alinsky had that one down. The example to me of the case of the person with a soul is Ted Turner. Okay. Now I don't know Ted Turner. Linda and I were talking about that the other day. I don't know Ted Turner's background entirely, but I have been following him for a couple of years. Recently, he was going to run a special on old growth.
Audubon.
And it was the Audubon Society was putting it on. Stroh's Beer was going to sponsor it. And the timber growers came and said, you know, we're big beer drinkers, right? You sponsored that, you know, and we'll never buy another Stroh's ever. Nobody. No timber grower in this country. Well, it's Stroh's thought, oh, geez. They pull out. So they pulled out. Well, then Procter & Gamble, you know, starts chewing his fingernails and says, well, you know, we don't want to do anything controversial. We don't deal with controversy, so we better pull out too. So they pulled out. So there's Ted Turner sitting there with his $2-3 million special he's going to put on with no sponsors. So what does Ted Turner go? He goes and shows it anyway. He said, I don't care. This is important. So what he did is he ran the special, and he did in the spots where the Stroh's Beer ads and the Procter & Gamble ads are going to be, he runs specials on what's coming up next week or, you know, this next month. Okay? He's come out with a new program called Earth Feet. I haven't seen it yet, but I just heard about it. The program has to do with positive things, where you can actually call. You can, you know, it tells about environmental issues, and it says this is where you can call to get more information. This is when you can write. And it has, it's the first television show of its kind that actually does that kind of thing. So that's the kind of thing I want to look for. I want to find those people and give them support. Write them cards. Let them know that I'll buy their product. I'll listen to their show. And I won't buy from Procter & Gamble or Stroh's. That's it. I don't have to, you know. So the point of it being that that's the only reason that any of these changes, I believe, are occurring the way they are. Yes, their bottom line is still the issue. But we are the ones who will control them. And we need to put our message out and look for the people with some soul.
I guess I understand pretty well about what you're saying about approaching things from a social conscious point of view. A lot of these companies that we're dealing with, I'm probably more familiar with the auto industry related type of things like Ford and Volkswagen. When we make things uncomfortable or difficult or unprofitable for them, they not only pick up and leave the town, they leave the country. They're making cars in Brazil, they're making cars in Mexico, where the environmental regulations are not as stringent, where the people don't make, you know, a hundredth of what they were paying the workers in Detroit. How do we deal with these kind of issues? How do we, you know, suddenly we've got plants closing, hundreds of thousands of people out of work. Now they're on our social, you know, welfare programs. We're paying our taxes to support that. And, you know, they're just out and gone.
Who's got an idea on that one?
Terrorists.
A good idea.
The great equalizer.
I'm still a pacifist.
Yeah. You're paying the price.
No,
it's that's the whole idea. That's the whole idea, is to tell them, no, you can't escape the country to beat the buck. You can't, that you can go out of the country, but you're still going to pay. And you might as well stay in the country and keep the jobs here and play the game in a way that we think is right. But unfortunately, tariffs is like the worst word in Washington,
D.C. I guess what I'm getting at is it's not a national state issue. It's a global issue. It's an international issue. All these companies are international now.
Yeah.
They don't care about us. They don't care about Americans.
Oh, yeah.
Anybody else. They're going to go where the money is.
If it's right. But what, I mean, I...
Yeah, look for the good companies.
What do you, I mean, to me, during World War II, AT&T was building radar equipment for the British and anti-radar equipment for the Germans.
Texaco was selling gas from the Bahamas to German U-boats.
Sure.
And Getty was living in New York.
Sure. So that's what we're up against. It goes deep. The loyalty is, I think we should see it as anthropologists and just say, okay, this is another view of the beast, you know? Like you're looking around and you're saying, oh, here's a snapshot. Wow, here's the ear, you know? You look up, this is the nose, you're looking in the mouth now. This is an example. We just see these and we get the picture. Because I think all in all, throughout this whole process, we have to understand it's these kinds of things, and when we talk about being sensitive to it, we need to just, all you need to do is go through the papers every day. Be sensitive to picking up. It's a little reminder. And I think that's
it's so multifaceted. It's, you know, you deal with one issue, say a pollution issue, and you buy according to pollution control measures, say. But yet they may not have equal employment right, or, you know, for women or blacks. Or, you know, there's How do we as Christians make value judgments on which ones, which causes, how we're going to buy to support the causes?
That's a real dilemma. There's a good book, two good books that I'd like to recommend, and one I've already recommended, which is in your bookstore here. Buy that. It's a good $5 investment. Take an hour, read through it, and then take it with you when you shop. Pretty soon it'll get pretty familiar. But the model they use is the same model that this other book that I want to recommend does. It's called Rating Your Rating the Corporate Conscience. And both books use the same model. And what they say is, you have to be the judge. They give you essentially 12 categories. One of the categories is, do they do testing on animals? How are they regarding racial issues? How are they with women? How are they on labor issues? How are they with the environment? Do they do nuclear power? Do they do weaponry? How are they with South Africa? There's several, two or three others. Each of those, you can make a profile that fits your priorities. That's the best we can do, because we're not going to find a perfect company. We're not going to find it. We're in the midst. We are pioneers. Okay, those of us who are in this area are still pioneers and will be for some time. We need to recognize that. We just have to take and work with a very imperfect system and say, this is my issue, this is what I care about, these others are important, but I can only do this much. If I have to buy soap, I'm going to buy it from the company that is fairest to women. And then just check it through, and you can check and see which one gives you the most positive profile, buy that. And that's it. But the other key to it is, let the company know. Let those companies know that you're not buying from. Just as you would let the... That's what's the critical one. Because they need to know that too. If you don't buy from Exxon, let them know why you're not buying from Exxon.
You know, Scott, I think I really agree with this. One of the issues that has struck me about people who are more progressive or liberal in our thinking, I'm putting myself in that camp, is that we just can't, I don't think we can come to agreement on issues and things. For example, the conservatives, this American Family Association, whatever it is, put out this newsletter every month on it, examining sexuality in our TV shows and things like that. And they flat out tell you which companies are advertising on these things. They have this newsletter. It's very well organized, and it's working. And people are writing letters to them. But we, as progressives, can't agree on the issues that we want to attack. And we can't get organized. I mean, I think it's, in general, the problem with the Democratic Party is that they can't find a thing to unify around anymore. And the Republicans, that's why they're blowing us apart. And they've done it for 8 years now. And I think that liberals need to somehow put away some of their differences and agree on certain issues and go after it and attack it. And conservatives are just beating it at their own game, and they're doing it much better than
I. I think that I would agree with that statement. I think that's a fair statement. The Republicans are far more unified. Republicans, for all the Republicans in here, Republicans are more unified, if there are any of us in here. And the conservatives certainly have done that. But if you look, there's another side of that too. And if you look through that profile of that book, for example, Rating the Corporate Issue, you will see in that profile those 10 or 12 issues, essentially the liberal agenda. That's our agenda. Anti-nuclear, pro-environment, affirmative action, racial issues. So we do have more unity than we give ourselves credit for. So what we have to do with that is we have to say, okay, within that, I'm going to buy a bar of soap, and this company looks pretty good, but it still doesn't do much on labor issues. And buy it anyway because it's the best. But I do think that you're right, and there's also another side to it, which is that one, that we do have an agenda, which is the parameters of it are becoming fairly clear, and they're around some issues. Most conservatives, if you poll them on those issues, would be opposed to them. So that's I would just add that to what you're saying.
I think there's another route. And that is through many individuals who are intimately involved and work with corporations. Obviously, huge corporations are systems, and a particular individual can only exert a certain amount of of influence. And sometimes that's very small, but sometimes that's very, very large. Probably the decision to go with a single-hulled ship versus a double-hulled ship in the Exxon Valdez tragedy was made principally by an individual. Certainly the captain of the ship was an individual who made a decision about how to manage that particular ship. I can tell you that the morale in Exxon in Norway was at an all-time low when that accident happened. They felt that, those people felt that the oil industry had a chance to show the world that they could transport oil safely, and once again they shot themselves in the foot. And they know what that means. That means probably no leases off of the California coast. You know.
Yeah,
it does mean that.
So they're keenly aware of the price that the company paid for probably several individuals' decisions along the way. They were interestingly enough, for example, they were committed to the proposition at Exxon that if you had an alcohol problem and went through a recovery process, that you would be reinstated in your job afterwards if you successfully completed the recovery process. That policy is now out the window. No more will a recovered alcoholic be reinstated into their previous position. That's one of the prices in the industry of that particular accident. What? Well, I know that, but I mean, I'm just saying.
Knee jerk.
That was one of the responses where they had tried to be what I would consider basically responsible before that policy. Now they've reverted. Now maybe they'll get climbed up back up out of that in time. But I always remember during the Vietnam era, the folks that went around the country saying, you know, there are going to be wars until the politicians offer them and nobody shows up. But that ultimately is the only solution, is that when a war is offered and nobody shows up, that wars will stop. Some of the hopeful signs that I see are that the loyalty to corporations has diminished substantially now. Where people used to give their heart and soul to the corporation. Like Exxon's a good example. Years ago, when people went to work for Exxon, they thought, I'm guaranteed a job for life. About 4 or 5 years ago, they had a major shakeup in Exxon. Thousands of people lost their jobs. The loyalty to Exxon now is zero.
Yeah.
And so, I think that's going to be interesting to see what happens, because now you see in the papers in the country these one-page ads by major oil companies, for example, trying to build a positive image, talking about all the stuff they're doing for humankind. And, right? Yeah. You know, Phillips does that. I've seen them in the Smithsonian, the full-page ad in the Smithsonian talking about how wonderful Phillips Petroleum. And Phillips, which is a smaller company than Exxon and doesn't make headline news like Exxon, is probably the absolute worst when it comes to dealing with people, you know, firing them without, you know, notice and shipping them off here and there and just the way they, you know, treat individuals.
Yeah. Texaco, too.
Yeah, I don't know anything about Texaco.
Response to what you said, Scott, were you finished?
Well, I was just going to say, I think we have, I think that there is large, these multinational corporations are systems, in which individuals get lost. But there is also another side of it, that they're made up of individuals like you and I. And perhaps, it's kind of the old principle, if they offer a war and nobody shows up, if the company, if people simply refuse to knuckle under, you know, and they need those people. Most companies now are going to an evaluation, they're going to an upward evaluation system because they've been forced into it by their employees. Instead of having supervisors evaluate employees, you now have employees evaluating supervisors in major corporations. Employees have got sick and tired of being just evaluated by people that often didn't even know how well they did, you know.
Those are good changes.
Yeah, so there's some really interesting things happening, and the question is, I suppose for us, I don't know how effectual we can be if we get stuck in thinking just about these systems, which are very oppressive. It's almost like you get, I mean, what in the world can we do? But we can influence the lives of specific individuals who make decisions about, are we going to have a two-hulled ship or a single-hulled ship, you know? And maybe there's more than one way to look at this. Maybe just how much it costs isn't the only issue here. Maybe there's a whole... I mean, also, part of that tragedy, for example, was the fact that we, the taxpayer, decided at one point through our governmental systems not to install the safety devices on the other side of the... We're going to save money. We're going to spend it on stealth bombers instead of installing safety equipment along the shoreline, right?
Right.
I mean, wasn't that a very complex...
Oh,
I'm not really a student of that whole thing, but my wife's telling me here I need to shut up. I think it influences individuals. That's what I'm trying to say.
I had an encounter.
Oh, shit.
My one response to that, Scott, was that I had an encounter with a guy who was an upper-level executive with Gulf Oil before he retired. His name, he got a nickname in the company, Crazy Charlie. He told me this. He said, what I would do, he said, Gulf Oil among the companies, and that's how I knew about Texaco. He said, in the industry, Texaco had the reputation of being the worst.
Yeah.
That was his opinion.
Yeah.
But he said, he'd sit at meetings, he said, and there would be decisions that would be made about this lease right or that. He said that they knew the letter of the law was correct, but the spirit of the law wasn't, and everybody knew it. So what Charlie said he got the reputation of being one of was the guy who said, oh, that's crazy. That's why he got Crazy Charlie. That's crazy. And that meant, I think that's BS. And what he became in that was a chance for everybody else in that organization who had doubts to kind of funnel it. He said people would route things through him if they had their doubts about him, because they knew when they hit his desk it would die. They'd never see it again. And so by his speaking out, by being Crazy Charlie, he was exerting an influence sort of through the back door, you know. I have had an experience like this real quickly. I was at a dinner one time with relatives. We're sitting around the table. The average age at the table is over 80, right? Okay.
And you were doing genealogy.
Right. So we're talking about this and that, and the National Geographic comes up, and the issue of the dumping of nuclear waste in the harbor comes up. And somebody said something. Yeah, well, you know, it was about San Francisco. I said, oh yeah, I brought it up. And they said, there was a silence. And I said, Yeah, I think it's really a shame. I think it's really bad. I'm sorry it's happened, because those barrels are going to leak and blah, blah, blah. And there was a little silence. And then on the other end of my tail, my uncle says, well, I had my doubts about that. I don't know about that. He said, that didn't seem very good. I didn't like that. Well, it was like, that was Crazy Scott, right? And he had an opportunity through me in that situation to speak out. And he could come back a month later and say, yes, remember when we were talking about that nuclear issue at the table there? It opened the door. And that's what I echo from what you're saying, is that people do have an influence. We all have an influence on people. And if you can help people open the door, that's a big thing, you know. And it's probably one of the few things we can do really solidly to have an influence on somebody who can make a difference.
Does it work anymore to be an individual and buy stock in a corporation, to go to the stockholders' meetings and to raise a stink?
I know
a man who was upset with Standard Oil's policy with what they were doing in Haiti, and he was Christian and bought stock in Standard Oil and got other Christians to buy stock in Standard Oil. And then they went to the stockholders' meeting and raised this huge stink of how they were killing lives of children, etc., in Haiti. And Standard Oil invited him to be on a committee, and they started up a development program, and they're putting, you know, millions of dollars into development in Haiti because of what he did. He also happens to be a very, very strong evangelical and fairly conservative, but wanting to do this for the poor, the people of Haiti, it helps that he's an extremely dynamic speaker.
Mm-hmm.
Flamboyant. But I don't know if that's become now kind of a popular thing, and it's much easier to do now than it used to be. But he was obviously very successful at it, and it worked.
It worked with Continental Airlines. Continental, I believe it was U.S. or Continental, was sending refugees back to El Salvador. Stockholders got together on that one, a group of stockholders, put pressure on, and essentially they dropped the contract. That worked. It worked with the infant formula thing. That was that's a textbook case now.
The Nestle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So and that it's was back a, on again.
Well, yeah, now it's back on, but it worked. You know, that's just a case of eternal vigilance. Mm-hmm. But it had its effect, and it was a powerful tool. I mentioned Saul Alinsky. Saul Alinsky was a powerful old organizer in the 60s, 50s and 60s. He maintained that was the only way. He had some very creative ideas. He had proposed the first fart-in. He was serious.
Here we go.
He wanted to go
with a hole and die.
Yeah.
He had Saul Alinsky suggested. Kodak firm was discriminating against blacks, and they had every year a great big hoopla at the big opera, right? So Saul Alinsky wanted to get by like 50 or 100 front row seats and have all the blacks go in and sit in the front row seats after they'd eaten beans and just literally gas everybody out. He had fun with his plans, but he never used that one. He did use a couple against an airline where they went in and they plugged up all the toilets, you know, before, because they found out that when flights would land, people would run to the toilets because, so they occupied all the toilets. But he was he was great. You want some good reading. But this was all Saul's way of evolving his approach, see? And he finally came to the conclusion that the stockholders' vote was the only vote in this country, and that was the way to affect corporations. So that's his answer, and it has worked in a few limited cases, probably more than I that's all I know.
It seems like it would take an immense amount of energy.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. It would take a lot of time and commitment.
What's
that?
Well, being role models, for the little that I've done, I've had so many friends come up to me and say, you know, I saw you recycling and turning out lights and buying low on the food chain and all this other socially responsible stuff. And they started doing it too. And they started telling their friends. And then every now and then you get that golden opportunity where you run into somebody, like you say, that works for a company in just some obscure right. position, and you kind of rub off a little on it. And then they kind of go, yeah, hey, there's other people that think like that, and then they do it too, and maybe our role initially, at the very least, is just to be role models and to assert that in our own lives.
And I like that. I like that. Yeah, that's good.
Well, it's about 9:30. Shall we call it quits?
Thanks for stimulating.
Thanks.
Well, thank you. Yeah. What a treat. Thanks for having me.
Do you want to say a word about what you're going to do tomorrow morning?
Yeah. Well, I'm going to discuss the issue of, take this issue down to a little more personal level on the economic simplicity. We're going to talk a little bit about some of the pressures that go into that, and at the 11 o'clock, session, we'll have a little bit of a workshop.